Today, why Manchester City has been banned from Europe's biggest football competition. And gene editing, how could it affect you?
To think about when I was a kid in Manchester, the idea that Manchester City would have the Brazil international centre-forward and the Argentina international centre-forward playing together in the same team, it's just, you know, a fantasy.
The Guardian sports writer David Conn has been watching the changing fortunes of Manchester City for years. The team was struggling along in the Premier League's middle ranks when they were bought by the billionaire Sheikh Mansour, a member of the Abu Dhabi royal family, in 2008. Since then, they've signed the world's best players and won 10 major trophies, including a treble last season.
And it means that Manchester City have won the FA Cup to add to their Premier League and League Cup titles in this unprecedented...
But on the 14th of February, the club was fined £25 million and banned from the Champions League for two seasons after they were ruled to have broken UEFA's financial fair play rules between 2012 and 2016. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, what went wrong for one of the world's richest football clubs?
When I was growing up in Manchester in the 70s, Manchester City and Manchester United were actually equally big and successful clubs.
Manchester City to kick off. The Blues against the Reds. The Blues attacking the goal.
But after the late 70s, City became this kind of hapless club where they got relegated.
Manchester City, one of the most accomplished clubs of a few years ago, are relegated.
All sorts of misfortune happened to them. And we had the return of a very famous centre-forward who'd played for City called Francis Lee, who came back to take over the club in, I think, 1994, and he coined a phrase that said, if there were cups for cock-ups, City would have a trophy cabinet full of them. They had more relegations in the 90s, and then they actually went down to the third tier of English football for the first time ever in their history. And they were down there with some, you know, very small clubs. Famously, they were only promoted through the playoff final after an equaliser was scored in something like the fourth minute of injury time against Gillingham. That was a real kind of watershed, a sense that they'd gone as low as they could go.
So as they head into the 2000s, what was their reputation like?
Across football, I mean, I think that people had quite an amiable view of City as the kind of real Manchester club that was so different from United. And then City had this huge luck, this huge good fortune that happened to them, where Manchester City Council had bid to host the Commonwealth Games in 2002 and to make the stadium sustainable afterwards and not be a white elephant. It was designed to convert to be a football ground. And obviously, Manchester United have a stadium at Old Trafford that seats 76,000 people. So City, even though they were in the third tier at the time that the negotiations started, were still the natural tenant to occupy the stadium.
Welcome to Soccer Night on an historic evening for Manchester City Football Club. Their first ever competitive fixture at their brand new City of Manchester Stadium.
And they were promoted back to the Premier League in 2002. So by the time they occupied the new stadium in 2003, they were back in the Premier League and they've not been relegated since then.
Do you think this really changed the mindset at the club?
So yeah, it took them out of the old ground at Main Road, which was much beloved by the supporters, but had also been the home of the ups and downs of the last 25 years or so. And yeah, I would say that launched them into a view that they could now become a solid Premier League competitor. But even after that, things still didn't go smoothly. They had local owners, and they found that they couldn't really keep financing the club as they wanted to. And in 2007, City were taken over by this controversial character called Thaksin Shinawatra, who was actually the ousted Prime Minister of Thailand, who had been ousted in a military coup in Thailand. And to be honest, that was a point where if you were a Manchester City fan of a certain age and you'd grown up in the 1970s with the local ownership, the British team, it just seemed like the ownership of football clubs in England was becoming quite surreal at that point.
He does sound like quite an unusual choice. What happened to him?
Thaksin not only had a somewhat dubious human rights record from when he'd been the ruler in Thailand, but he was also being accused of corruption by the new military government. He only lasted 1 year, and towards the end of the year, his assets were frozen. He was prosecuted for corruption, and he actually became a fugitive from justice.
Money. With more than $1.5 billion of his assets frozen by the Thai courts, there's doubt Dr. Thaksin can now afford to play at the painfully expensive high end of Premier League football.
Again, they had a huge stroke of incredible fortune.
The Abu Dhabi United Group for Development and Investment say they've bought Thaksin Shinawatra's share of the club.
Sheikh Mansour of Abu Dhabi, a member of the ruling family in Abu Dhabi, was looking to buy a football club at that time. City fell into crisis at that time, and he bought Manchester City.
At this point, Manchester City had just finished ninth in the Premier League. What impact did the new owners have on the club?
One thing which they did literally the day they took over, which they actually said was a statement of intent. I mean, I don't think the takeover was even actually completed, and they signed the Brazilian international player Robinho.
I hope to show my best football and bring lots of joy to
for £32 million.
So to Mr. Thaksin and the Abu Dhabi group, who made a lot of effort to bring me here.
And then when we got to the summer of 2010, they signed Yaya Toure, the great, great midfield player. And they signed David Silva, who's turned out to be one of the greatest players ever to play for Manchester City, a Spanish international. And then the following summer, in July 2011, they signed the Argentinian striker Sergio Aguero. And, you know, people can forget how much money they were spending. I mean, Aguero wasn't that famous in this country at that time, but they still paid £38 million for him.
These huge changes at Man City meant that they were able to start competing with clubs like Manchester United and Arsenal at the top of the Premier League. And then we've got the 2011-2012 season. What happened then?
Well, they won the FA Cup in 2011, and it was the first trophy, first major trophy that they'd won since 1976. So 35 years. And they had their ups and downs in that season, 2011-2012. And then very, very famously, and almost like became an iconic moment in the Premier League, they played Queen's Park Rangers, who actually were in danger of getting relegated, in the final game of the season, which would have won them the league. But instead of winning it easily, they were actually losing right into the 90th minute at the end of the game. They scored an equaliser already into injury time. And then in something like the 94th minute...
Manchester City are still alive here. Balotelli, Aguero!
Sergio Aguero scored a dramatic winner at the very, very end of the game. And, you know, went wheeling off with his shirt over his head, and everyone in the stadium went absolutely mad. And, yeah, I mean, people instantly burst into tears. There were City fans of a certain age who literally started crying the minute that goal went in. And it was very, very emotional.
Stupendous!
People obviously look at the money. You know, people said, well, they've just bought the league. They've done this by having an owner from a country in the Gulf. And they've not grown in the way that football clubs used to. And that is true. But equally, football support. It's a family culture. It's part of people's lives. I mean, I went to that game basically as a reporter, and there was one guy that I'd known over the years, and he always went to the game with his dad. His dad was there, and he said he had cancer now, and he was definitely coming to the end of his life. And they just wanted to be at a game together where City were going to actually win the league. And, you know, so what it actually means to people, it's woven into people's lives, into people's family lives, into people's sense of themselves, into people's sense of where they're from, their sense of home. Even with all the money and modern football and how it's structured, it was a really remarkable victory, landmark in the history of Manchester City.
That began a really successful time for the club, and they went on to win the league three more times. And it was just before that first big win that new financial rules were introduced into the game. What were they?
UEFA, which is European football's governing body that runs the Champions League, they introduced financial fair play in 2010 to 2011, and it was a major governance reform. European football was going through the greatest financial boom that it had ever had in its history, principally because of pay television. But the majority of clubs in Europe, including in the Premier League, were making losses, and many of them were falling into financial difficulties. So what they came up with was actually quite basic, which is clubs should live within their means. They shouldn't be overspending on players' wages and making huge losses that are bankrolled by an owner. Because in most cases, that owner will end up having limited finances. And at some point, as happened with Manchester City with Thaksin Shinawatra, the money runs out, but the club is still saddled with all the wages. And that's what leads to financial crisis. So they set actually quite strict limits on the losses that clubs could make. And the Premier League introduced its own financial fair play rules in 2013, and it's transformed the finances of Premier League clubs, because they go from overspending on players' wages and making losses. The overall picture in Europe now is of financial sustainability and profit.
And in 2014, Man City breached these new rules by making a bigger loss than they were allowed to.
When it was assessed in 2014, City's recorded deficit was 180 million euros. You could make a maximum deficit of 45 million euros. So they could have been banned from the Champions League at that point, and UEFA could have been very, very hard on them. But instead, they did a settlement with City, and they basically said, if you agree not to take some prize money to limit your squad to a certain number, and also not increase your a couple of sponsorships from Abu Dhabi, which were seen to be too high, then actually it's fine. We're not going to sanction you in any way. And City took that settlement a bit grudgingly, moved on, and because they became so successful and competed in the Champions League after that, you actually make so much money from being successful in football, from being on television a lot, from playing in the Champions League, from all the big matches that you're hosting, that then the finances, the money started to come in much more, and City started to turn it round to actually become close to breaking even, and then they actually started making a profit. So they weren't under real threat of breaching FFP after that.
So all seems well on and off the pitch at Man City. But then this big moment happens in 2018.
Yeah, so it actually came as a huge shock. Out of the blue, in November 2018, the German magazine Der Spiegel had what they called leaks of internal Manchester City emails, and actually internal emails of UEFA's and of other football clubs and organisations, which City absolutely defiantly said were hacks, that their emails had been hacked. And what they most explosively suggested was that City's sponsorships, in particular from the Abu Dhabi state airline Etihad, which is a main sponsor of Manchester City, that the money was not actually coming from Etihad. And that what the email suggested was that Sheikh Mansour himself was funding the bulk of the Etihad sponsorship.
And why were these leaks quite so explosive?
So the level of that sponsorship with Etihad, which now sponsors the stadium, so it's actually called the Etihad Stadium. They wear the Etihad name on their shirts, and it also sponsors the campus, the academy, was £67.5 million. So if Sheikh Mansour, as one of the documents showed, was actually paying £59.5 million of that sponsorship, and Etihad was only putting in £8 million, then there's two issues. Number one, the owner is putting in vastly more money than was realised. But the crucial issue is it's a question of trust.
So City had been overstating the amount of sponsorship they were getting from Etihad. And according to UEFA, the club had misled them about how they were being financed. Then just over a week ago, we found out what the punishment for this was.
Manchester City have been banned from the Champions League for the next two seasons.
What happened?
So the Valentine's Day gift from UEFA to Manchester City was to find them guilty of a very serious breach of the financial fair play regulations for overstating their sponsorships. And they've given them pretty much the maximum penalty which anyone really thought City would face. And that is a two-year ban from the Champions League, plus a €30 million fine. And that is a major, major body blow to the modern Manchester City, the Abu Dhabi project for Manchester City, in just about every way.
Initially, Manchester City were furious about this, saying that the process was flawed. And then last Wednesday, the club's CEO, Ferran Soriano, spoke in a video on their website.
The most important thing I have to say today is that the allegations are not true. They're simply not true.
And in terms of the owner putting his own money into the football club via sponsorships?
The owner has not put money in this club that has not been properly declared.
They've said, we've got irrefutable evidence, we've got a comprehensive body of evidence that shows these charges aren't valid. But they've also very much gone on the attack against UEFA and its processes and essentially accused these people on these panels of being biased and of not being impartial and of prejudging it from the very beginning, that they were always going to find City guilty. And part of the email leaks was internal emails within the club that showed how hostile and confrontational they actually were to UEFA, even when they were going through the financial fair play process. And they were threatening to sue UEFA over just financial fair play itself, like try to get financial fair play ruled to be illegal or against European law.
And what about the fans? What have they said?
It's always hard to generalise about supporters because, you know, there are tens of thousands of supporters. But City supporters in general have been very much on board with the new owners.
On BBC Five Live.
I believe in my club and its integrity. And I'm hopeful that we will overturn this very unjust verdict.
The Manchester City fans you talk to, who are not the day trippers, will tell you where we've been and where we are now, being banned for two seasons, honestly. Bring it on. Make it four seasons. I'm not bothered.
It's been fantastic football for people to watch. There's in general, a great sense of loyalty towards the ownership and in general, a hostility to be honest, to the concept of financial fair play. It's been portrayed as if it was a plot by the elite to stop this kind of spending, to stop a club like City coming to challenge.
How bad is this for a club like Manchester City to be banned from the Champions League? Like, what does this ban mean?
It's a huge body blow to City. And I think you can break down the ways in which it is. And in some ways, I mean, the financial hit is actually really, really high because they probably make around more than £80 million a year from being in the Champions League, because you get huge television money from UEFA, plus you have the big games that you host. But that's almost the least of it. It's a huge blow to their status and, you know, what they've built since Sheikh Mansour's takeover. They've expertly worked on their image as well while they've been owners of Manchester City, not to be seen as, you know, a flash Gulf country just spending silly money on players, but to be seen as responsible investors and owners and doing all the work in the communities.
Could players leave as well?
Definitely, they're at risk of players leaving. They're at risk of the manager leaving. I mean, the manager, Pep Guardiola, he has said that he will be staying at Manchester City.
If they didn't sack me, I would stay here 100% more than ever.
But, so, you know, for the players, I mean, their reason for being at Manchester City is, yes, obviously they get paid incredibly well. But, you know, playing football is still a short career. And 2 years out of the Champions League, not for reasons on the field, like you didn't qualify, but for some, you know, something that the hierarchy has done that's come down as a sanction from UEFA, and then you don't get to play in the Champions League for 2 years.
Is there any potential for the club to be able to appeal this? Could the ban be overturned?
City have said absolutely that they're going to do that. They're going to appeal. And so we now wait and see when that's going to happen and what the outcome of that's going to be.
David, is UEFA taking a risk in bringing this action against such a big club? I mean, it's going to deny fans some of the best players in the Champions League.
UEFA is taking a big risk. UEFA themselves did a settlement with City in 2014. They didn't want to ban City from the Champions League at that time. So I'm sure that it's a huge headache and a confrontation with a major club that's now being escalated to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, which they can live without, because the people at UEFA don't get up in the morning wanting to ban clubs from the Champions League, especially clubs that have got some of the best players in Europe playing for them.
Manchester City have got some of the best players and they've enjoyed so much success on the pitch in the past few years. But if this judgment is upheld, there are going to be big questions over how they financed it all. What does all this say about the role of money in the game today?
A lot of people who don't know too much about football who'd be listening to this must think it's just extraordinary that the sport that we used to call the people's game is just so wealthy now, and that our clubs, which, you know, were community institutions, I mean, Manchester City, like many clubs in Britain, was originally formed as a church team, you know, in Victorian Manchester, to provide something wholesome for the lads to do in a deprived area. And for these clubs, as we still call them, to be businesses that get taken over by Gulf state interests, obviously this episode is bringing that into focus. You know, the scale of the spending that was done by Sheikh Mansour and the Abu Dhabi hierarchy around him to transform what people used to think of as the noisy neighbours or the neighbourhood Manchester club into the elite. Obviously, there's a focus on that, but UEFA would say we've brought these rules in to encourage clubs to be sustainable in this era of financial boom. And if you break the rules, then there are sanctions that apply.
David, thank you.
Thank you.
That was David Conn. He's written extensively about this for The Guardian, and you can find all of his work on the website. Coming up, the power of gene editing. Now, what would you do if you had the power to edit your genes and alter your DNA? Gene editing technology has the power to change life as we know it for all of us. But much of the reporting on it has focused on the technology, the big discoveries, and the scientists who made them, rather than the people most affected. A new Guardian podcast series, The Gene Gap, is putting new voices at the centre of this debate, from farmers in Cumbria to parents of children with additional needs in Hertfordshire. Alok Jar is one of the series' producers.
Gene editing is a relatively new technology that's going to have some seismic impacts on the way we live our lives. The idea is that you can very precisely edit the DNA of people's cells, not only people, but plants and animals. And not only is it going to help us to better understand how living organisms work, it could help to eliminate certain genetic diseases, and it could transform the food we eat. However, it raises a huge number of questions about what it means to be human and who gets to control this technology. We travelled the country and convened five groups of people who were not experts in gene editing in any way, but who brought experiences with them that would give them an insight into this technology. There were farmers from Cumbria, members of the Black and ethnic minority communities in Birmingham, the parents and carers of people with genetic conditions in Hertfordshire, a group of young people in Manchester, and some scientists who were at the very start of their career in London. The themes that emerged were quite interesting. We talked a lot about identity. If you change your genetics in some way, are you still the same person? There were some people who were very confident that this was going to be a good thing and that it would be useful for them or their relatives who perhaps were in pain or in suffering.
My daughter's got an extra chromosome and I would absolutely delete that. And it's not to change her, it's to change that extra chromosome that holds her back.
And then there were others who disagreed. They knew that their relatives, for example, had certain conditions that were caused by genetic problems, but they didn't want any of that changed.
We need to have more acceptance of people's differences and encourage people to be different. If we go down the route of deciding who should and shouldn't be alive in this world, then we are playing God, and I don't think we have a right to do that.
Another theme that came out was power. If this technology becomes available, who gets to use it? Some groups of people say that the public should be involved. The farmers we met in Cumbria had a slightly different take, that the public have this sort of hypocritical way of looking at the world, which is that they want everything to be natural and unaltered and all those things, but then they also don't acknowledge that it takes a lot more than that to actually produce the food they eat.
We hear time and again that the public want food raised in an ethical way, they want free-range hens, they want cows that live on grass, they want all this sort of thing. Yet when they turn up in the supermarket and they've got the choice between organic eggs at X price and you know, factory-laid eggs, off they go with the cheaper option every time. And it's heartbreaking to us because we're trying to do the job right.
The most interesting thing for me was hearing people talking about trust. Now, who do you trust to use this technology? If you look at any surveys around the world, generally speaking, people trust scientists, they trust doctors. And so you might assume that if scientists and doctors come up with the technology and the medical applications of it, right, okay, that's good. But we heard that actually not everyone thinks that's such a good idea.
Our history of being abused by science shapes us. And even though many of us have got mums or aunts that work in the NHS, we still have an understanding of the legacy of being excluded from medicine, being used as guinea pigs for medicine. So we probably have more questions and more critical of things like this, especially with histories of eugenics.
Often we don't hear those stories when it comes to new technology. We just breathlessly say how wonderful everything is. We learnt so much from talking to all these different groups of people, but possibly the most important is that if society wants gene editing to fulfil its promise, the promise that scientists tell us about a better world, better food, all those things, then hearing from non-expert voices is going to be a really important part of how gene editing develops. Scientists need to bring the public with them.
That was Alok Jar. Do listen to the Gene Gap series at theguardian.com. Thanks to Alok and David Conn. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.